But he'd have to register his ship with the International Astronautical Authority, wouldn't he? I asked. Father nodded. Sooner or later he'll have to, or be declared an outlaw vessel. I'm not giving my prize money to an outlaw. We lifted off in the clipper ship with no problems. In 10 minutes we were on orbit, approaching rendezvous. I started to feel queasy in zero gravity. My stomach went hollow and I felt as if I were falling even when I could see that I was safely strapped into my seat. If I moved my head I got dizzy and nauseous. So I just sat there quietly trying to keep myself from throwing up while the clipper ship went through its docking maneuvers. It seemed like hours. But as soon as we were docked, a feeling of weight returned and I started to feel all right again. My ship, Hesperus, was designed specifically for the Venus mission. She was too small and cramped for the long flight from Earth. To ferry Hesperus out to Venus, we had leased an old factory ship from the asteroid belt, named Truax, and refitted her for the task. The two vessels were connected by a buckyball cable and rotated around their common center of gravity, so there was the equivalent of a regular Earth gravity aboard. We didn't do that just for comfort. The gravity on Venus is only a few percent less than Earth, and if we had coasted out to Venus on zero-G, our muscles and bones would have been deconditioned during the 2-month flight. This way, with artificial gravity induced by spinning, we'd be ready for diving into Venus's clouds as soon as we parked in orbit around the planet. Once we were cleared to unbuckle, I went straight from the clipper ship to my stateroom aboard Truax. It had been the captain's quarters when Truax had plied the ore route between the asteroid belt and the Earth-Moon system. I saw that it was adequately furnished, although a bit shabby. Still, the fold-out bed felt comfortable enough, and the wall screens all worked. There was enough room to avoid the feeling of being cooped up. No windows, but the wall screens could be programmed to show any view I had in my video library. I checked the closets and the lav. All my clothing and personal toiletries were in place. Good. The medicine cabinet was fully stocked with my enzyme supply, and 3 syringes were laid neatly in the drawer beside the sink. Fine. Still, the stateroom had the faint odor of strangeness about it, the lingering residue of someone else's presence. I never got to feel completely at ease there. Certainly, the built-in desk and other furnishings weren't in a style I would have picked. That couldn't be helped now. I gave myself an injection and then went to the desk. There was business to be attended to. Duchamp was the captain, very well, but how dare she kick our astronomer off the mission and substitute someone I haven't even met, a biologist, no less. I asked the intercom system to locate her. In a few seconds, her lean, sharp-featured face appeared on my screen. "I need to speak with you, Captain," I said, laying just a hint of stress on the last word. "We're in the midst of a systems check," she said, her expression flinty. "I'll be free in 1 hour," and her eyes flicked away for a moment. 11 minutes. "In my quarters, then," I commanded. She nodded, and the screen went blank. I waited in my stateroom. I could have gone out to the bridge, it was hardly 10 paces down the passageway, but I decided it would be better to make her come to me, establish the authority. She'd been named captain, she'd won that battle, but I'm the owner, I told myself, and she's not going to run roughshod over me. I hoped. 1 hour and 12 minutes later, she knocked once on my door, opened it, and entered my stateroom. Her coveralls still looked crisp and fresh. If the systems checkout had strained her in any way, it certainly didn't show in her appearance. I stayed seated at my desk. With a gesture, I invited her to sit in the nearest chair. She sat and crossed her legs, but for the first time since I'd met her, she looked tense. Good, I thought. "About this new crew member," I began. "It's not your place to make personnel substitutions." "I'm aware of that," she said. "Then what do you mean by displacing our astronomer with a biologist, of all things? You can't—" "The fact that she's a biologist was not uppermost in my decision," she said sharply, cutting me off. "What?" I must have blinked several times. "What do you mean?" "Her name is Marguerite Duchamp. She's my daughter."
"Your daughter?"
"My daughter."
"That's rank nepotism. We don't need a biologist. I don't want a biologist. You can't bring your daughter on this mission."
Duchamp merely raised an eyebrow and said,
"My daughter comes with me."
"It's impossible," I said, as firmly as I could manage.
"Look," Duchamp replied, with ill-concealed impatience, "your father wants me out of his way, okay. But I'm not going to leave my daughter on the same planet with that humper. Not with him. Understood?
I gaped at her. Beneath that icily cool surface, she was burning with rage. And I understood why. My father had dumped her because he'd become more interested in her daughter, and she was furious about it. They say that hell has no fury like a woman scorned. But what about a woman scorned because the man wants her daughter? Then I wondered how the daughter felt about it. Was Duchamp protecting her daughter against my father's unwanted lechery? Or was she dragging her away, kicking and screaming? Either way, it looked to me like a nest of snakes.
We left Earth orbit the following day and started on the 2-month-long trajectory to Venus. We had to burn more propellant than the minimum energy trajectory would use, but I figured that cutting the transit time in half was worth the expenditure. I hardly felt the thrust when we broke orbit. I was standing off in one corner of the bridge doing a media interview while the working crew attended to their jobs. Off to Venus. It was a good news subject. Fine human interest. Van Humphreys setting out to recover his dead brother's remains from the hellhole of the solar system. Later that evening, when I saw the network's broadcast, though, they showed more computer simulations of what Venus's surface might look like than they showed of me. But my father kept worrying about Fuchs, bombarding me with tension-riddled messages. Where was he? What was he up to? It made me worry, too. No matter. We were on our way to Venus. That was the important thing.
Dream. I knew I was dreaming, but somehow it didn't matter. I was a mere child again, a toddler just learning to walk. There was a grown man looming in front of me, holding his arms out and calling to me. Come on, Van, you can do it. Walk to me. In my dream, I couldn't make out his face. His voice sounded kind, friendly, but his face was somehow hidden from me. Come on, Van, take a step. Come on. It was enormously difficult. Much easier to hang on to whatever piece of furniture my chubby little fingers were clutching. Or just plop down and crawl on all fours. But his voice beckoned to me, half encouraging, half pleading, and I eventually let go. I took a teetering step, then another. Good boy. Good boy, Van. I saw his face. It was my brother Alex. He was only a child himself. 9 or 10 years old, but he was helping me, encouraging me. I tried to reach him. Step by labored, dangerous step, I tried to get to his welcoming arms. Instead, my legs buckled and I plopped onto the floor.
You're hopeless, runt. Absolutely hopeless.
Suddenly, it was my father towering over me, disgusted look on his face.
The ancient Greeks would have left you on a mountaintop to feed the wolves and crows.
Alex was no longer there. He was dead, I remembered. I sat there on the floor and blubbered like a baby.
In transit. I had met the crew several times before we left Earth, of course. The crew of my ship Hesperus, I mean. Truax had its own crew. An even dozen of grizzled, experienced men and women. But I had practically nothing to do with them. Captain Duchamp handled that part of the mission. It was my crew, the crew of Hesperus, that I cared about. In addition to Duchamp and Rodriguez, there were only 4 others. 3 technicians, for communications, life support, and sensor systems, and the physician. The comm and sensor techs were women about my own age, rather nondescript techies who talked in jargon and kept pretty much to themselves. Same for the life support guy, except he was chubby and rather surly, the kind who always gave the impression that the least little technical problem was the end of the world. They had to be good, though. They had been okayed by both Rodriguez and Duchamp. Naturally, all our systems were actually run by the ship's mainframe. The human techs were needed for repairs and maintenance work, mostly. For a while, I had thought about using robots instead, but Rodriguez convinced me that the humans were more versatile and handier. And cheaper, too. The one crew member I dealt with on an almost daily basis was the physician, Dr. Waller. He kept tabs on my anemia and made certain that I was in good general health. He was quite a bit older, about Duchamp's age, and claimed he had never used any rejuvenation therapy for himself. Yet he looked suspiciously young to me. The only sign of his age was his thinning hair, which he kept pulled back in a short ponytail. He was black, from Jamaica,
and for some reason